From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, poet Michael Ryan talks with us about secrecy and sexual obsession. In his new memoir, Secret Life, he reveals that he was abused as a child and later developed what he describes as a sexual addiction. Also, we remember poet and novelist Mae Sarton. She died Sunday of breast cancer at the age of 83. She had chosen a life of solitude and introspection since the age of 45. Her poetry and journals about solitude inspired her readers to reflect on their lives as she reflected on hers. We'll feature a 1989 interview with her. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Former White House lawyer Vincent Foster is being described as having been disturbed by President and Mrs. Clinton's statements over the Whitewater matter before his death. The Senate Banking Committee is holding a second round of hearings into the matter. The first witness was former Associate Attorney General Webster Hubbell. He said that the White House staff was profoundly affected when it learned of Foster's suicide.
There was no way that Vince Foster, this could happen to Vince Foster. And so we were all blaming ourselves. We were guilty that we didn't. What could we have done to prevent this?
Republicans are questioning why Foster's office wasn't sealed immediately after his death. Some suggest sensitive papers, perhaps regarding Whitewater, could have been taken from his office. Democrats are largely discounting this theory. Senator Christopher Dodd used his opening remarks to say he hoped the committee would soon turn its attention to more pressing national problems.
But I do hope that we can get this job done and move on to what I know all of my colleagues share are the far more vital, important issues of this Congress. And that is, of course, dealing with our deficit issues and the problems of Medicare and Medicaid and the like, all of which deserve our attention.
The ranking Democrat on the House International Relations Committee is calling on President Clinton to work with NATO allies to strengthen U.N. forces in Bosnia. But Congressman Lee Hamilton says sending in U.S. helicopters is not the answer. NPR's Carol Ann Clark-Kelly reports.
Representative Lee Hamilton says the president should give the United Nations forces at least one more chance to show that they can protect the remaining safe havens. Hamilton says he supports stepped-up airstrikes, but he would reject a French request to supply U.S. transport and attack helicopters.
If you put American helicopter pilots going back and forth into there with the positioning of the guns and all the rest of it, I am told that casualties can be expected. Looks to me like the risks are very high for widening the war and getting the United States directly involved. I don't think that's a war the United States people will support.
Hamilton says he also opposes calls for lifting the arms embargo, arguing that this too would draw the U.S. even further into the conflict. I'm Carol Ann Clark-Kelly in Washington.
The death toll is still increasing from the week-long heat wave. Authorities now blame the weather for at least 422 deaths nationally. Chicago authorities have counted 199 fatalities. There are hundreds more bodies at Chicago funeral homes and the morgue that must be examined. The Cook County Medical Examiner says he expects to classify most of those deaths as heat-related. The heat has eased somewhat in the east as temperatures cool to the 80s and 90s, but a new pocket of hot air is pushed into Oregon, giving parts of that state temperatures as high as 102. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 52 points at 46.83. This is NPR. The House Judiciary Committee has voted to impose jail terms of up to 2 years for doctors who perform a controversial form of late-term abortions. The vote was taken along party lines. It would outlaw so-called partial birth abortions. Critics call the vote diabolical. Doctors and lawyers, or rather lawmakers, have fought over how to define the procedure. Defenders of the procedure say it's rarely performed in situations to protect the health and life of the mother when the fetus is badly deformed. The bill does not bar all late-term abortions and makes exceptions if the woman's life is endangered. California Governor and presidential hopeful Pete Wilson's campaigning to overturn affirmative action policies. In a speech to business employers today in Los Angeles, he made a pitch to do away with affirmative action's admissions policies at the University of California. NPR's Mandalit Del Barco has more.
Pete Wilson repeated his earlier controversial criticisms of affirmative action programs, what he calls preferential treatment in hiring, contracts, and college admissions. He challenged regents of the University of California to come up with alternative policies.
Any so-called underrepresented minority who applied last year and met the minimum standard was automatically admitted, even though other, more qualified students were rejected. In short, if the UC admission system were given a grade for fairness, it would get an F.
Wilson plans to address the university regents Thursday when they meet to debate a proposal to scrap the use of racial categories in admissions, hiring, and contracts. I'm Madalit Del Barco in Los Angeles.
The government says the trade deficit rose to a new record in May, $11.4 billion. The gap in trade of goods and services is 0.1% higher than it was in April. It was led by higher demand for crude oil. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our interview with Ralph Reed, head of the Christian Coalition, which was scheduled for today, had to be rescheduled. We expect to have it for you tomorrow. You know, I'm sometimes stunned by the things I don't know about the people I interview. For instance, back in 1989, I interviewed a poet named Michael Ryan. His first volume of poetry, published in 1974, had won the Yale Series of Younger Poets Award and a National Book Award nomination. I was particularly struck by a poem in his 1989 collection, God Hunger. Before I tell you more about Ryan, I want you to hear that poem. It's about how, as a child, his father forced him to play a game called Milk the Mouse, in which the father takes the child's pinky and squeezes it hard between the father's thumb and forefinger until the child can't stand it anymore and screams for the father to stop. The poem has the rhyme scheme of a villanelle.
He'll pinch my pinky until the mouse starts squeaking. The floor lamp casts a halo around his big stuffed chair. Be strong, be tough, it is my father speaking. I'm 4 or 5, was he already drinking? With its tip and knuckle between his thumb and finger, he'll pinch my pinky until the mouse starts squeaking. Stop, Daddy, stop. It was more like screeching. And kneels down before him on the hardwood floor. Be strong, be tough. It is my father speaking. What happened to him? That he'd do such a thing. It's only a game. He's doing me a favor to pinch my pinky until the mouse starts squeaking, because the world will run over a weakling, and we must crush the mouse or be crushed later. Be strong, be tough. It was my father speaking to himself, of course. To the child inside him aching, not to me. But how can I not go when he calls me over to pinch my pinky until the mouse starts squeaking? Be strong, be tough. It is my father speaking.
Poet Michael Ryan recorded in 1989. Well, shortly after the broadcast, I got a phone call from a poet friend who told me that Ryan had a reputation as a womanizer and for coming on to his college students. That's a side of the sensitive poet that was hidden from me and obviously from our listeners. But that discomforting biographical insight was nothing compared to the shock of seeing Ryan's new memoir, in which he confesses that for most of his life he's been addicted to sex. He started seeking help and changing his life in 1990. His memoir, aptly titled Secret Life, was described in the Sunday New York Times Book Review as extraordinarily absorbing and disquieting. We invited Michael Ryan back to talk about it. I wanted to know what it was like to keep such a big secret from the people he met.
Well, it was horrible. I mean, now I'm happy to say what you see is what you get. But the real burden was on myself. That's why having a secret life, a shameful secret life, is self-destructive more than anything else. I mean, it can hurt other people, but it's mainly a self-punishment.
I find it really interesting that on the one hand you were writing poetry that was very honest about the experiences that you chose to describe in poems.
Yes.
On the other hand, you had to lie a lot to people in order to not reveal really personal things about you.
Well, they were lies of omission.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so.
So you feel like you never describe things in a false way, you just didn't say what it was you were doing.
Nobody knew about them.
Mm-hmm. Why did you decide to write your autobiography, Secret Life, and to tell about your sexual obsession?
Yeah, well, I had to get at this. I'd come to the end of the road with it. It was hurting me too much. It was, every addict is two people, I think. Every addict is both a human being and what I call in Secret Life this no-I driving me to be no one. And they're always in conflict. And it just came to a point where I had caused too much damage and suffered too much damage to not deal with it explicitly. I had broken up. My second wife and I had broken up, and I had a contract to write a book of essays about poetry, and I was on the last essay, and I couldn't finish it. I had to turn to something that was going to deal with the causes of this chaos, and this was it.
I'd like you to read an excerpt of the very beginning of your memoir, Secret Life.
Okay. This is from the first chapter, the very beginning of the book, which is called Soul Sickness, and defines that condition, I think, for me. Every sex addict has his own thing, the thing he likes the most, although like is hardly the word for the inexorable pull I felt and sought and sometimes still feel, but with God's help one day at a time, do not act on. It's as if an electronic magnet in my solar plexus were switched on. At its most intense, I'd go into a kind of trance, dissociated, beamed in from Mars, my mouth dry and my heart pounding, my usual waking consciousness hovering somewhere outside my body while I was taken by the pull. One of my partners once said to me, "You are like another person when we go into sex." That's how I put it, too, go into sex. Any way I could get there was fine, but the best way was anonymous sex with a teenage girl, initiated by a secret touch. I spent most of my adult life in public watching for her, checking every prospect for what I called the look, pouting, furious, damaged, sullen, short skirts, tight jeans, halter tops, spike heel pumps. My primary loyalty was to sex. No human relationship took precedence over it, not marriage, not friendship, and certainly not ethics. Achievements were meaningless unless converted into sexual rewards.
In that reading, you say, you know, a former girlfriend said to you, "You're like another person when you go into sex." Mm. Did you think of yourself as being like another person when you were engaging in sex?
I think I thought of myself as being the real person when I was going into that state of mind. That just always seemed to me the truth. And I guess that's why that feeling is I first had when I was sexually molested. And sexuality was cast into that mold for me.
You were sexually molested by a young man in the neighborhood when you were five?
Five years old, yeah.
So what was the connection between what you felt when you were molested and what you thought was your true self when you were older and having sex?
I think there was some sense in which that interaction, that state of being with another person was the truth. That was the truth. There was no other truth. Everything else was an approximation or an excuse for it or a sublimation of it or whatever. this was reality, and that's what I sought.
What kind of things turned you on? Were you into, you know, like sex and danger, or did you have any kind of specific types of obsessions?
I think, yeah, as I say in that passage, anonymity was the main thing. I mean, it was the more that I was known by somebody else, the less erotic it was to me.
So to keep it anonymous, did you have to have a lot of partners, keep changing partners?
You bet. Yeah.
And like how often, how many partners do you think you'd have
I don't
a year
really or? Have... I really don't know. I haven't counted, but it was another part of the self-punishment to make that demand on myself, because that's very hard to do, you know, to get that kind of supply, again, to talk about it in terms of an addiction, to keep that supply going is really, really impossible.
You're a poet. You're really into the subtleties of language. Do you think it should be called sexual obsession instead of sexual addiction? There's something that troubles me about sexual addiction, and I've been trying to think of what is troubling to me about it. And one is, I think that it's equating it with, like, on a literal level with a drug, you know, like heroin or alcohol or something. And also that because it equates it with a drug, it kind of absolves the person of any responsibility in a way. You know, it's like a chemical thing that takes over. Sex seems different to me than, say, heroin.
Well, I think it's the latter part, the notion that it absolves one of responsibility that bothers people. But on the contrary, I think certainly myself and every addict is responsible for what he does. He's still a human being on the face of the earth. In terms of it's differing from substance abuses, in my own opinion, though again, I don't care about convincing anyone else, there is no difference. It is an altered state. It was an altered state for me. And it was certainly my drug of choice.
You write, for each woman I seduced, there were 2 more I tried to seduce and 10 more I wanted to seduce but couldn't. So what I experienced most of the time was failure and frustration.
Right. That has to do with the notion of the unending supply and the difficulty of maintaining that.
So were you, in some ways, like an unfulfilled, unsuccessful addict?
I guess so. I mean, sure, every addict is unfulfilled and unsuccessful. There's just no way any addict in any substance can get enough of whatever it is that he wants.
You ask a very interesting question in your memoir. You say, how do you change your sexuality? How do you change what turns you on? Did you find an answer to that?
Yeah.
What?
Well, the 12-step program that I'm in provides me with an alternate way of being, one day at a time. And I've learned through the cultivation of the kinds of spiritual values that are part of that program that it's possible to really take more joy in giving than getting, and that you just don't have to worry about what you get if you believe that it's supplied to you by a higher power.
But does that really answer the question of how do you change what turns you on?
Yes, because that changes me, again, one day at a time, and that changes everything. Whereas before, sex was the center of life to me. Now it's a part of life, and it's a blessing and a gift.
I think sexuality is one of those real mysteries of of human life, and a lot of people, I think, are really baffled why certain things that might turn them on in film or in literature or in fantasy, they wouldn't actually like in real life. You know, for a lot of people, there's this real split between their sexual fantasy world and their real sexual world. Was there ever a split for you, or did you merge those
that
two?
That was and just... part of the problem, that there was anything that, and I believe I say this in the book, anything that I would fantasize, I would do. There was no distinction. In fact, not only would I do, I would have to do. I would feel impelled to do. I would feel obliged to do. That if I didn't do, I was somehow not strong, not powerful. That if I really wanted something, I should get it. I should be that strong. And it's an awful and outrageous way to live.
What about pornography? Have you ever read or watched much of that? And would you do it now, or would you consider it dangerous for you now?
I wouldn't do it now, just because that form of sexuality I associate with for me, again, not trying to speak for everyone, but just for me, would be toxic and not the kind of sexuality that makes me happy now. I do have a lot of problems with pornography. I think most of it is used by sex addicts.
My guest is poet Michael Ryan. He's the author of the new memoir, Secret Life. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Michael Ryan. His new memoir, Secret Life, is about his sexual obsession. One of the many things I didn't know about you when I interviewed you the first time around was that you were actually fired from Princeton in 1981.
Actually, it was suspended.
Suspended.
Yeah,
okay.
Suspended with pay.
Mm-hmm. What for what specifically?
It was for seducing one student and propositioning another.
Now, did word get out about you after that?
It certainly did. Yeah, that was very well known in the literary world and very humiliating experience for me because it made me the subject of a lot of conversations that were reported to me by people who I didn't know. And there were a lot of both true and false stories about it. I mean, I had a reputation before that, but that certainly solidified it.
How did it affect your career as a writer?
Well, that is hard to say. I didn't have a full-time teaching job, a permanent teaching job, for 10 years after that. I had part-time teaching, and... whether it affected the way in which people read my work or not, I don't know. It probably did.
You're teaching now.
I am, yes.
Is it hard for you to be around young women when you teach?
No. If that situation ever arises, and my book ends with a situation in which it does arise, in which I am propositioned by one of my students, and I'm able to maintain that boundary between us, because without the maintenance of that boundary, again, speaking only for myself, the whole sense of the human value of the interaction is lost. And so it's really important that I not sleep with my students, so I don't.
Well, what happened to you in your life that made you think, I've got a problem and I want help?
Well, that's also, I write about that in the first chapter of the book. I was on my way to seduce the 15-year-old daughter of one of my friends, and And I just realized that there was something really terribly wrong with me if this was something that I wanted to do so much.
So what'd you do after that?
Well, I turned around and I went back to Boston, which is where I was living, and I felt like blowing my brains out for quite some time. And I went to see a therapist, and the therapist again suggested that I go to a 12-step program, and so I started going to a 12-step program.
There's plenty of, say, tabloid TV shows that you could be a guest on, and at the bottom of the screen it would say, Michael Ryan, colon, sex addict.
Right.
And do you think there's a difference between the kind of tabloid interest in other people's sexuality and other people's sexual problems, the difference between that and what you've tried to do in your memoir?
Yeah, well, I certainly hope so. I mean, what I tried to do in this book is render my life. I mean, it's a simplification, necessarily so. The book does not contain everybody that I knew or everything that I did, but it contains a certain narrative and it contains a certain argument. And what that wants to do is render something in a significant way, with as much complexity within the simplification as possible. That's wholly different from the way in which this subject might be treated by a tabloid TV show.
Let me ask you a question that I realize might make you uncomfortable. But when you meet people for the first time now who know you through your memoir about sexual obsession, do you think that they're, especially women, uncomfortable around you and thinking like, oh, no, am I turning him on? Is he staring at my body? you know what I mean.
Yeah. I don't know. Again, it's very fresh. The book has only been in the bookstores for 2 weeks. People's response has been remarkably generous. I mean, the people that I know, it's not been judgmental. It hasn't been, oh, you freak, you weirdo, you pervert. It has been, oh, you human being, oh, you sufferer, oh, you wrote something wonderful about it. So, so far, the experience has been a wonderfully healing and rewarding experience.
But has it brought a new level of self-consciousness to your interactions with people?
No, again, what would be the case anyway, whether I wrote this book or not, I hope what would be what you see is what you get. I mean, I'm here, I don't have to hide anything anymore, and that's a great relief. But writing this book was part of the agency for coming to this sense of being about myself. So I don't think it could have happened otherwise. I feel terrifically healed by it. It has changed me.
Michael Ryan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Michael Ryan has written a new memoir called Secret Life. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Mae Sarton was admired by her readers for her writing and for the life she had chosen, the life of solitude. She lived alone in Maine and chronicled the latter part of her life in a series of published journals. Sarton died Sunday of breast cancer at the age of 83. Coming up on Fresh Air, we'll remember her with a 1989 interview.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Oklahoma bombing suspect Timothy McVeigh has refused to provide a grand jury with a copy of his handwriting. He's defied a subpoena and a judge's order. McVeigh refused, saying he didn't often write the way they wanted him to and that using the unfamiliar style would violate his constitutional rights. The directive had asked that he use the cursive method of handwriting. The judges asked attorneys on both sides to submit briefs within 5 days in preparation for a contempt hearing. Prosecutors want McVeigh's handwriting samples to compare them with writing on documents involved in the case. A House committee has passed a bill that would put doctors in jail for up to 2 years if they perform a certain kind of late-term abortion, NPR's Chitra Raghavan reports.
Anti-abortion groups call the procedure partial birth abortions. Abortion rights groups and doctors call it intact DNX. The procedure involves suctioning some of the fetus's brain fluids to collapse the skull, making the fetus easier to remove. Anti-abortion groups say it's a horrifying method, but the National Abortion Federation says doctors resort to this rare, late-term procedure mostly to protect the health and life of the mother and or when the fetus has severe abnormalities. But the Federation says a small number are done on an elective basis. The bill passed by the House Judiciary Committee would impose jail terms of up to 2 years and or a fine for doctors who do this procedure. The bill would also allow the father, or if the woman is under 18, the maternal grandparent, to sue the doctor for damages. I'm Chitra Raghavan in Washington.
Prosecutors and defense attorneys have outlined their cases in the double murder trial of Susan Smith. She's charged with the drowning deaths of her two young sons. Suzanne Stevens of member station WFAE reports from Union, South Carolina.
The prosecution and defense agree on one thing in this case, that Susan Smith was not insane the night of October 25th. She knew right from wrong, as the legal definition of insanity requires, when she allowed her car to roll into John D. Long Lake with her boy strapped inside. The parties disagree on Smith's mental stability that night. Defense attorney Judy Clark told the jury they need to hear about Susan Smith's turbulent upbringing to understand what brought her to the breaking point that fall night. In contrast, Keith Gazay of the prosecutor's office told juror Smith knew exactly what she was doing, and he would focus on the events from October 25th until Smith finally confessed. The first witness on the stand was Shirley McLeod, who lives next to John D. Long Lake. She was the first person to hear Smith's concocted story of a carjacker. For National Public Radio, I'm Suzanne Stevens reporting.
On Wall Street today, stock prices fell sharply from yesterday's record high. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 50 points to end the day at 4,686. Declining issues led advances by a 2-to-1 margin in heavy trading of 372 million shares. This is NPR. The House will open hearings next week on a bill to reauthorize the Securities and Exchange Commission. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
A freshman member of the House Commerce Committee has announced that he plans to conduct the first top-to-bottom review of the SEC. Representative Dan Frisa, a New York Republican, has been appointed to lead his committee's review of the commission. Frisa says the agency has grown since its founding in 1934 into a $300 million a year operation with almost 3,000 employees. He also says the SEC collected $487 million in fees in 1994. The SEC was designed to oversee securities trading following the stock market crash of 1929. Meanwhile, the SEC says it will join with securities regulators in the United Kingdom to study the operations of brokerage firms that trade in derivatives and securities across international boundaries. The collaboration would mark the first joint initiative to assess the global activities of major international securities firms. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
Japan's transport minister says he'll hold trade talks with Transportation Secretary Federico Peña Thursday in Los Angeles. The two are expected to discuss a brewing battle centered on air cargo routes, but the Japanese official said he wouldn't accept what he called unfair and unilateral demands by Washington. The United States has threatened sanctions against Tokyo unless it grants requested routes to Federal Express. Meanwhile, Japanese trade officials are discounting an agreement reached between the two countries on automobile trade last month. An official summary of the agreement says the deal does not guarantee results. Russian President Boris Yeltsin says he's had a heart attack. He told a television interviewer he is on the road to recovery and his convalescence will be complete. Yeltsin stood during the entire interview with Russian public television, which lasted about 5 to 7 minutes. Questions have been raised about Yeltsin's health after an official photograph that supposedly showed him in the hospital last week. There are claims the photograph was actually taken last month. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Writer Mae Sarton died Sunday at the age of 83 of breast cancer. Her journals about living alone and aging were perhaps her best-known books. She had chosen the life of solitude since the age of 45 and lived on the coast of Maine. Sarton was also a prolific poet and novelist. She became a heroic figure to many of her readers because she had the courage to go her own way. We're going to remember Sarton with a 1989 interview recorded after the publication of her novel The Education of Harriet Hatfield, about a 60-year-old woman who for the first time comes out publicly as a lesbian. It was in 1965, after writing several novels about married couples, that Sarton wrote her first novel with a lesbian protagonist. Sarton once said, "On the surface, my work has not looked radical, but perhaps it will be seen eventually that in a nice, quiet, noisy way, I have been trying to say radical things gently so that they may penetrate without shock." We spoke first about her need for solitude.
Well, I've always needed a lot of it. You see, I was an only child. My father, a scholar who was very concentrated on his work, my mother, an artist. That is, even in my family life, I was a solitary. I loved other children. I mean, I'd rush off to school early in the morning. It's not that, but solitude has always been a necessity for me, partly because I think I believe this is true of everybody. You really only experience something when you have the chance to sit down and think about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've said that without solitude, you feel you lose your center.
Yes, that's right. Because your center, after all, is made out of your thinking about what has happened to you. And it's constantly being remade. But if you too much clutter, it's just what I feel about my house right now. There's so many little things. I'm just going to get rid of the clutter. And that's what solitude does for you.
Now, how remote is your home?
Well, it's not really very remote, but there's nobody within. If I was attacked, nobody would hear me scream. It looks down a lovely field to the ocean, and what you hear all night is that sighing of the ocean. And when I first came there, I used to think that there was a train going by somewhere, and then I'd realize it was the ocean.
Do you worry about being attacked?
No.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one, I'm a fatalist, and two, this is a very remote place, and three, it seems a very benign town. I mean, it's hard to imagine something violent happening there.
Mm-hmm.
When I first came, I did get some threats, but that was a private vendetta against me by some people, and that was frightening when I got a note saying, you know, enjoy it now, we're going to get you, and things like that.
Yeah.
But then I went to every single, I went to the post office, I went to any shops or cleaners, that kind of thing, florist, and said, you told them the situation, and said, never tell anybody where I live. It's rather hard to find, and nobody has found it. So that's really worked very well.
Mm-hmm. As much as you like solitude, you've also called it your self-imposed solitary confinement. And in your journals, really, there's really quite a bit about depression.
Oh, yes. Well, I think it's inevitable if you're a writer, a serious writer, there's bound to be some depression. You can't every day get up and say, I'm a genius and everything's great. I mean, you're fighting something all the time. A lot of the time you're in conflict. And some of the writing certainly comes out of that. For instance, my novel, Anger. Anger has been a constant in my life. I'm an angry temperament in some ways. And I wanted to get at that. And so I really wrote the novel to find out myself what it was all about. And this is what my writing is anyway. It's a lot of the time is to find out what I really feel, what I really think about something.
A lot of your readers identify so strongly with your writing and I think even want to be you. And you've said that there's something wrong when solitude such as yours can be envied by a happily married woman.
Why?
Did I say that?
Yes, you did, in one of the journals.
Because I don't remember that, because I think it's fairly natural. In other words, there are these opposites in all of us. There's a part of me which would love to have a large family and now be a grandmother. And there's a part of every woman who's married and has the responsibilities of children and who just thinks of my life as ideal. I mean, she does what she wants. She gets up when she feels like it. You know, she goes for a walk with her cat. And that's the other side. It's just that we are all such a bundle of opposites, I think.
I know exactly what you mean.
You know, that's really it. But then I am certainly dedicated in the sense that there is one thing in my life that I would give up everything else for, and that is my work.
Your writing.
My writing.
We're featuring an interview with writer Mae Sarton, who died Sunday at the age of 83. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with our 1989 interview with Mae Sarton. You've said that we have to make myths of our lives, and I think in a way you're making a myth of your life through always writing journals.
Yes, although I started very late on that. But I think that the answer about the myth is that you have to have an image of yourself which is viable for you. And my image of myself does have to do with solitude. There's no doubt about that. And then the enormous response to the journals, which are written, of course, in solitude and are mostly about the sort of sacred routines. Sacred is an odd word, but I really believe this to be true. And somebody compared me to the painter Vermeer recently in a thesis they were writing, because it was the sacramental of the ordinary. You remember the Vermeer women who are nearly always writing a letter or sewing or doing something very feminine and concentrated. And it the magic of these paintings, of course, is the light. But also the fact that we carry away an image of something very feminine, which is very precious. And I use even the word sacred. So I think, for instance, that if you can make dishwashing a sort of ritual which has meaning for you. It's a tremendous advance. And this is what I try to do with my life.
Does writing journals help you think of your life in that way?
It does, but of course I'd thought all those things long before. You see, I started my first journal, I think, when I was 60.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was late in my life. My life was shaped then. And it was an experiment because I was very depressed. And I thought, if I can write about this, maybe I can solve it. It was an unhappy love affair that I was involved in. And in fact, in that book, the lover is X, neither man nor woman. I'm a little braver now than I was then. But anyway, the people, you know, are always saying, why is it X? And I just say because I was shy then and not as honest as I am now.
Has your view of solitude changed as you get older?
Yes. I think it has in one sense, and that is that friends are very, very precious because I can't work as much. And because of heart trouble that I now have, it's not serious, I'm not going to die of it, but it makes me unable to work for weeks at a time. And then I realize how precious the friends are who can come and talk and be with me. Whereas I really haven't needed that very much until now. And I think that is something of the beginning of old age. But there's also solitude, you see.
Well, you know, I think that for a lot of people, the greatest fear is the fear of being old alone.
Yes.
And the greater fear is of dying alone.
Yes. I can see that very clearly. I'd like to die alone. I mean, I think it would be easier than perhaps having people around. But we all have death in our minds. I mean, after about 60, certainly, I think you can't escape that. I have the feeling, and I've said so in the journals, that we grow towards death. And it's a it's the last great adventure, and we have to be prepared for it. So that I find being old in some ways very exciting, in other ways very limiting, and therefore, I get cross and I get depressed because I can't do things that I want to do anymore, like gardening.
You had a stroke a few years ago,
yes.
And you have a journal about recovering
That's
from
right.
the stroke. You were alone when you were stricken. How did you cope with that? How did you cope with getting
to the
hospital?
Well, I waited until 6 o'clock because I didn't want to bother anybody. And at 6, I called a friend of mine who's an RN and said, Janice, I think I've had a slight stroke. And she said, call the doctor at once. I'm coming right away. We'll get an ambulance. And the whole thing began. But you see, it was, luckily, a slight stroke. I was able to pack my suitcase, but I wasn't able to get my breakfast. And it was the left side. You see, that's where I'm so lucky, because if it had been the right side, I wouldn't be able to speak, probably. And I write about what it affected. It was very strange what goes on in your head. I mean, for about a year, I felt quite crazy. All the past just flowed through me, and I couldn't escape it. I was pursued by images of my whole life. So thank God that isn't happening now. And I think I'm now fairly well, and they keep tabs on the possibility of another stroke, of course. I mean, you take medicine and things.
You have a poem with you. Would you read that for us?
Yes, and this fits in, I think, quite well with what we've been talking about. It's the title poem of my last book of poetry, which was called The Silence Now. These days, the silence is immense. It is there deep down, not to be escaped. The twittering flight of goldfinches, the three crows cawing in the distance, only brush the surface of this silence, full of mourning, the long drawn-out tug and sigh of waters never still, the ocean out there and the inner ocean. Only animals comfort, because they live in the present and cannot drag us down into those caverns of memory full of loss. They pay no attention to the thunder of distant waves. My dog's eager eyes watch me as I sit by the window thinking. At the bottom of the silence, what lies in wait? Is it love? Is it death? Too early or too late? What is it I can have that I still want? My swift response is to what cannot stay. The dying daffodils, peonies on the way, iris just opening, lilac turning brown, in the immense silence where I live alone. It is the transient that touches me, old, those light-shot clouds as the sky clears. A passing glory can still move to tears, moments of pure joy like some fairy gold, too evanescent to be kept or told, and the cat's soft footfall on the stair keeps me alive, makes nowhere into here. At the bottom of the silence, it is she who speaks of an eternal now to me.
What a nice poem. You know, and I should mention that you write so much about your cats and dogs that you've had in your books.
Yes, they're very dear companions.
Yeah. Let me ask you, in 1982, you wrote out a check to a retirement community for them to hold for 5 years from then when you planned on joining. Whatever
yes.
happened with that?
Well, I discovered that the people I really wanted to be with, the former dean of the faculty at Wellesley was one of them, would be about 100 by the time I was 80 and going there. So I figured that it wasn't a good idea. And then when I went to see them, I found being in the dining room with nothing but gray heads and nothing but people on the way out. I mean, having difficulty in walking as I do now and all these things, that I found it terribly depressing. And so I canceled it. It's also quite expensive. I'm determined now to die where I am, in a house that I rent from good friends and right on the sea. And when the time comes, it would be cheaper probably to have a live-in housekeeper than to go to a retirement community. But you never know. I mean, what if I have another stroke? You just have to sort of take a chance.
Mm-hmm.
Live your life and hope it'll end well.
We're featuring a 1989 interview with Mae Sarton. She died Sunday at the age of 83. We'll conclude the interview in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, how are you following the latest developments in Bosnia?
Well, we'll be hearing from reporter Mike O'Connor about what the situation is in some of the safe areas in Bosnia, in Zepa and Garajda, both of which are now considered either lost or in jeopardy to the Bosnian Serbs. Also, we'll be hearing from the Bosnian foreign minister, who says that what his government wants is unrestricted air support from NATO. That is, no veto by the United Nations over what kind of airstrikes there should be, just NATO air support. Also on today's program, we'll be hearing about why the president of France is talking up an activist position in Bosnia, and about two men who'd like to change the world.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Writer Mae Sarton died Sunday at the age of 83. We're featuring an interview with her recorded in 1989 after the publication of her novel, The Education of Harriet Hatfield. Let me see if I can describe this novel a little bit. It's about a 60-year-old woman whose companion of 30 years has just died, and the companion has left her an inheritance with which she opens a women's bookstore. And she's being interviewed by a newspaper reporter, and the newspaper reporter asks her if she's a lesbian, and she says that yes, she is. And that's kind of the headline in the article. the headline is, "Lesbian Bookstore Owner Threatened." So suddenly she's kind of public and out, and after living a pretty isolated life, she finds herself in the middle of the lesbian feminist community. The novel is in a way about generational differences, I think, between older women and younger women who are lesbians. Do you see it that way?
Well, in some ways, yes. Of course, the point about her coming out as a lesbian is that she is threatened, and that it isn't that she's sudden, that she's... people attack her because the bookstore is not like what they are used to in a somewhat blue-collar neighborhood. So that the book is about homophobia, It's about how strange it is that so much hatred and violence can be created just by the presence of, in this case, a very discreet elderly lady who opens a bookstore. But we see these things happening all the time. And every incident in the book of violence is something I know happened. So, I mean, that's what I wanted. I wanted to try to say, look, I mean, here we are. We're just ordinary people, just like you. We have the same problems. We're not monsters. We're not... That's what I was trying to get at. And I'm happy because I had a letter yesterday from somebody saying, Harriet is adorable. This really took me by surprise. But you've created such a marvelously warm and funny and character, which is, of course, what I was hoping somebody would say, but so rarely happens.
Well, let me ask you a few things about Harriet and how, if at all, she relates to the way you've lived your life. She's a woman who is 60 at the time of the novel, and she was never really... publicly out before. She never really related to other women couples, hated the term lesbian because it seemed like such a primarily sexual word. Does that describe you at all?
I think it describes a great many people, and not only people my age. I think it describes a great many women who are living together and who somewhat shudder at the word lesbian. And it's beginning now to come out. In the book I have, and this really happened to me, it happens to me all the time, a young woman introduced somebody and said, "This is my lover." Well, you see, this does take me aback, but it's done all the time now. Men also. There, you're right. There is a generation gap, but I think Harriet somewhat really does jump over it in one way or another.
Oh, she definitely does.
Yes.
And do you feel that you have too?
Yes, but I think it's very difficult. I mean, I don't think it's easy to come out in front of an audience of 1,000 people and say I'm a lesbian and proud of it. But I do that, but I do it with difficulty. I mean, the homosexual community is a community which is on the whole not liked. You are a little segment that is So it's not easy. I think it's wrong to say that it's easy. And I think if this book has a value, it's that in a way it takes this not easy thing with perfect honesty and not minimizing it, but rather lightly at the same time, so that you don't put it down. You read it fast and laugh sometimes. That's what I hope.
Now, in 1965, you wrote a novel called Mrs. Stevens Hears the Mermaid Singing.
Yes.
And this was the first novel you wrote that had a lesbian protagonist in it.
It was actually a novel in which I came out, I think. Mm-hmm. I think that's fairly agreed to now. Got almost no good reviews, but is now a classic. It's taught in all the women's studies, the colleges. This is very nice, you know, to know that something that you wrote at a time. My agent, Dermot Russell, one of the best in New York, he's dead now, alas. But, I mean, he said, don't publish it, May, it's going to do you harm. And I said, Dermot, let me give it first to my publishers, to Norton, and if they don't like it, all right. But they did. And my editor at Norton, Eric Swenson, said, we think it's wonderful, and we want to publish it. So this was where they were wonderful. And it came out, as I say, it was no great triumph at the time, but with time, it has somehow, like a good wine, you know, it's gotten better. I think it's a much better book than the Harriet. It's a deeper book, and also mm-hmm. it's about women's creativity and about the difference between a woman poet and a male poet.
When the gay rights movement came along, did you identify or were you alienated from it initially?
I think neither, mm-hmm. because I had already come out, and also I had already made for myself a very solitary life which was not political, so that it's not in my kind of life to march, for instance. I'm rather ashamed of this. I wish I wanted to. But I think you have to be what you are and not pretend that you're something else.
Well, I think that's a really good point. And it seems strange to me that you'd be kind of embarrassed because, after all, what people love so much about your writing has to do with the life of solitude that you've led.
Well,
and
yes.
You really can't have it both ways.
No, that's true.
Can I ask you to read another poem?
Yes, I'd be glad to. This is a very short one, which was written for a friend of mine who's since died. But this is really about what it is to be a poet. It's called The Skilled Man, for Bill Vaughan. If someone should ask me how a poem is whittled and willed, just how it is done, you know, with what love, both wary and skilled, I'd suggest that he watch Bill make a thing that does not look hard, like the staff for an old knife, and learn that all that it takes to make a knife new or a word is the subtle exchange of a life.
Writer Mae Sarton, recorded in 1989. She died of breast cancer Sunday at York Hospital in York, Maine. She was 83. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.